placidly amid the noise and waste, and remember what comfort there may be in owning a piece thereof. Avoid quiet and passive persons unless you are in need of sleep. Rotate your tires.
Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN.
And heed well their advice.
We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And I am really, really excited about my next guest. That, by the way, was a piece from the National Lampoon album Radio Dinner, which was released in 1972. My guest, Tony Hendra, is one of the creative forces behind that and the creation of Radio Dinner and Lemmings and the National Lampoon Radio Hour. He was the first editor of National Lampoon. And he's seriously one of my comedy heroes. And there is a new album from National Lampoon, and it's their first album in 35 years. It's called Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight? And you can find it on the Final Edition website, and that's thefinaledition.com, and CD Baby and iTunes. And we have a link on our Facebook page. And this guy has been in the world of satire for a long time and is a giant in that world and a huge influence on my comedy influences as well. And I want to welcome Tony Hendra to the show. Tony, how are you?
I'm fine, Nick. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited to have you on the show. I've been such a huge fan for so many years, and I'm thrilled that you're releasing a new album.
Yeah. Well, it's been a long time since the Lampoon was capable of releasing an album. Unfortunately, the Lampoon in recent years has rather fallen on hard times, which is putting it politely. The more accurate way would be to say that the Lampoon over the last 20 years has basically been run by morons and criminals. And literally criminals, actually. The last proprietors, before the current proprietors, actually went to jail for kiting the National Lampoon stock. One of them for 4.5 years, the other one for 50 years.
Wow.
So the latter one was the CEO of the so-called magazine at that point. But the current guys are trying very hard to get the brand back into some kind of shape. And I had founded in the last few years this little satirical group called The Final Edition.
Yep.
Which is really dedicated to doing the only thing I know what to do, which is the Lampoon's kind of humor from its glory years, you know, smart, funny, reasonably in the know, and not at all afraid of offending people. And so it seemed a natural thing when we came to the point where we were going to put out our first album to go to the Lampoon and say, hey, you know, we're family. Why don't you guys be part of this and see if it can do you a little good? So that's really where Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight came from, and why the National Lampoon's name is on it as well as ours.
Well, that's great. That's really great that you reached out to them. That's I love that. I want to talk about, by the way, a lot of people who are listening right now would remember you, and I want to make sure I mention this. Who would remember you as Ian Faith?
Yes.
In Spinal Tap. How often are you asked to sign cricket bats? Does that happen?
Well, actually, not often enough. But I certainly am recognized a lot, even now, which is very gratifying since I'm losing my hair, and I certainly don't look that much like Ian anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's safe to say, in fact, that Ian Faith is probably a more famous name than Tony Hendra. But it is actually amazing how the film keeps holding up. I mean, it seems, you know, people half my age, a third my age, some of them have seen this movie and obviously connected with it and learned every line.
Yes.
Which I can't necessarily remember anymore. You know, I'm often, in fact, flummoxed, you know, especially if it's late at night when people come up to me and shout lines in my face, and I really can't remember what the context is. But I do my best. It really was a wonderful experience to make, and it's damn funny, I must say.
Yeah, it is. I want to talk a little bit more about that later, but I want to talk about how, you know, you took a very unusual path to satire. in a very unusual path to comedy. Can you tell everybody a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. In brief, because it's a long story, so I'll keep it brief.
Yeah, I mean, you wrote a book about it, so it is a long story.
Yes, I did. I wrote a book called Father Joe, Father Joe was a real person who was actually a Benedictine monk, closeted Benedictine monk. I don't mean that in the sexual sense, but in the sense that he was a contemplative monk, which meant that he lived behind tall walls in a monastery, did not go out into the world, but for all that was an extraordinary understanding of human nature, and above all was extremely funny. And I came into touch with him when I was in my mid-teens, about 14, 15, in very odd circumstances, which I won't go into. But to make a long story short, I really fell under this guy's spell. He was an extraordinary mentor, and for several years, I was a teenage monk. I definitely wanted to become like Father Joe, and spent most of my time dedicated to that. And even when I was getting ready to go to college, which in my case was Cambridge University in England, I was still dedicated to entering the monastery as soon as I'd finished my degree. But in the course of going to Cambridge, I saw an extraordinary show called Beyond the Fringe. Yeah. And Beyond the Fringe was a theatrical review which really for the first time brought all the sort of sacred goods of the fusty old British Empire into one place, one stage. You know, everything, like the BBC, Shakespeare, World War II, the Church of England, the Queen, the class system, I mean, you name it. It was all brought together and literally in a couple of hours eviscerated by this brilliant team of satirists. And so I saw Beyond the Fringe when I was a kid in college, and I went into that theater a monk. And I came out a satirist.
And, you know, some amazing talent in Beyond the Fringe. And Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Right. Yeah. Dudley Moore especially, obviously, is known to American audiences. But there was also Jonathan Miller, who became a great theatrical director, and a guy called Alan Bennett, who's now one of the most distinguished English dramatists around. So, yeah, they were great. They were just an amazing team.
Yeah. So, no, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and they really influenced an enormous generation of people my age and younger in England and in America too, because they came to Broadway. They brought the show to Broadway. Mm-hmm. And part of the group, which actually Peter Cook and Jonathan Miller belonged to, this group called Footlights in Cambridge, it was a bit like the Harvard Lampoon, except instead of doing parodies and so forth, they did a theatrical review every year, which is how Beyond the Fringe came to be. And after I had seen Beyond the Fringe, I headed for Footlights to try and get myself into that organization, which I was lucky enough to do. In my year, the year before us, David Frost had been the president of Footlights and was now down in London getting ready to do a show called That Was the Week That Was. And in my actual year, there was John Cleese and Graham Chapman of Monty Python. So I worked with John and Graham. In fact, Graham was my first comedy partner. And that was quite a way to...
I bet.
Got your teeth.
That's amazing. That really is. So, and what brought you to? How did you end up being the first editor of the Lampoon, of National Lampoon?
Well, again, to long story short, I had a partner. Graham decided to become a doctor, and so I had to get another partner.
Right.
But another partner from Footlights called Nick Ullett, and we came to America in 1964, right after the Beatles. And it was at the behest of a guy called Robert Chartoff, who later became the producer of the nefarious Rocky series, you know, 1 through 12. But he was the manager of a comedian, a young comedian, called Jackie Mason. Mm-hmm. And Jackie Mason loved us and said, you must come to New York. And so we did. That was the rest is history, really. I mean, we got off the boat one morning in 1964, in April of 1964, and the next, you know, that very evening, we were at the bitter end in New York City on Bleecker Street, and doing something called a hootenanny, and a hootenanny was like an open mic, but except for the sort of folkies. Mm-hmm. We brought the house down and got 6 months of work, the first gig of which was opening for Lenny Bruce.
Wow.
At the Agogo.
Wow.
Lenny was our idol, and so it was not just amazing. I mean, it was like America's everything we've been told it is, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
We get off the boat and we were opening for Lenny Bruce and driving up Park Avenue in an open top limousine. So that's written. And then we worked for a while horrible American television programs in the 60s. And eventually I broke up the act because I couldn't stand it. It really was terrible. It was terrible television. It was things like the Hollywood Palace and Ed Sullivan and that kind of show. And you couldn't do anything about what was going on around you in the late 60s.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Vietnam and sexual liberation and drugs and rock and roll and all the rest of it. Could not mention a word about that in the studio. Mm-hmm. So I heard about this magazine that was beginning up in New York and called the National Lampoon, and I started writing for it. And that's eventually how, within a few months, I became one of the editors.
That's amazing. Now, Tony, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right. Tony Hendra is with us, one of my comedy heroes. And the National Lampoon has released their first original album in 35 years. It's called Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight? And it's great. And you can check it out at thefinaledition.com. We'll talk about the final edition. We'll talk more about Tony's work with Lampoon and more. I'm just very excited. And we'll also talk about Spinal Tap a little bit later on as well.
But you all left me when the talks were laying on. Now I'm on the cover of the magazine. On your lawn.
Catch it, darling.
Throw it alone.
Catch it, darling.
Well, it's so long.
Ah.
I'm dying. Lonely at the bottom of the barrel.
At the bottom of the barrel. Only at the bottom.
Welcome back, everybody. Yeah. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of Trib Tower here till 5 a.m. It's Triple Play Thursday, 312-981-7200 if you want to get a request in. That was the late, the great John Belushi doing the Joe Cocker in Lemmings, which was started out as an album, became a stage show and a phenomenon, and launched the careers of several amazing people. And one of the creative forces behind Lemmings and behind the National Lampoon is Tony Hendra, who is seriously one of my comedy heroes, and I'm thrilled that he's on the show. And we're talking about a bunch of stuff, including the new National Lampoon album, the first in 35 years, called Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight? It's great, and you can check it out on our a link on our Facebook page to hear it. Tony, welcome back.
Hey, Nick, how are you?
I'm good. I'm very, very good.
You really know your stuff, I must say. That's great to hear. I haven't heard that for a while.
Yeah.
You know, at the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, no, great. I mean, beautiful stuff. I'm of the generation where I was when Saturday Night Live started. I was 10 years old, and I vividly remember watching the very first episode. George Carlin was the host,
right.
And it hit me so hard for those years, those formative years, that I devoured anything and everything that had to do with SNL, and that brought me to Lampoon. And so on and so forth. So these people that you worked with, and you were like the start of my comedy sensibility completely.
Well, good. I'm glad I corrupted your mind in the correct way.
Yeah, and you know what? And you worked with Python, and they were right there too. It was, and
yeah.
You know,
sure,
so
sure.
So. But we you know you became an editor at National Lampoon. Can you talk a little bit about the legendary Doug Kenny?
Yeah, sure. I mean, actually, Doug was not my editor. My editor was the other guy called. His name is Henry Beard.
Right.
But Doug was Doug was really the sort of leader of the National Lampoon. It's certainly of the magazine, and he was an extraordinary talent. I mean, he was not only incredibly smart. I mean, you know, like Harvard cream of the cream, but he was not a Harvard cream of the cream in a class sense. He came from a little town in Ohio, and so his touch was singularly brilliantly American. I mean, he was a Midwesterner as well as having, you know, the whole sort of overlay of Northeastern sort of sophistication and, for want of a better word, cynicism. So, I mean, that mixture was what made Doug so incredible. I mean, his masterpiece, I think, other than Animal House, obviously, which he helped write with Harold Ramis.
Right, and he was, by the way, for people who he was Stork in Animal
House. Yes, he was Stork. Yes. His masterpiece was something called the high school yearbook parody.
Yeah.
Which we put out in 1974, I think, which was ostensibly a high school yearbook from 1964, and just a brilliant take on American high school education. I mean, just the poor crippled girl with the crutches, you know, who was called Wobbles, I think, or something like that, to the permanent record which the hero Larry Kroger had laid out, his permanent record, this sinister thing that was going to go with him throughout his life and determined, you know, by the age of 15, determined everything that would happen to him. It was just a superb piece of work, and Doug, that was Doug's genius.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, the reputation that Kenny had, he was a very mysterious guy, from what I understand. And is obviously, and then, like, I mean, his death was incredibly mysterious as well too.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, as Chevy Chase, who was in Lemmings, I actually cast him in Lemmings, and was a great friend of Doug's, said when Doug died in Hawaii after either, as Chevy put it, falling off a cliff or looking for a place to falling while looking for a place to jump. and nobody to this day really knows why he did it, but he ended up at the bottom of a cliff dead.
Yeah.
In 1980, and with him went an enormous American talent.
Okay, Tony, hang on again, okay?
Yeah, sure.
All right, Tony Hendra is with us, a comedy icon, and you can get the new National Lampoon album, the first in 35 years. It's called Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight, at thefinaledition.com. I'm very excited to have Tony here, an amazing talent, and the new album is great, and it's available on CD Baby and iTunes as well, and there's a link on our Facebook page for it. Take a quick break, and we'll talk more with Tony Hendra right after this. Yeah. All right, we're jamming now. Now we're jamming in the studio here. Spinal Tap, of course, legendary movie, classic movie, and we all know every line of dialogue. Tony Hendra, who was one of the creative forces behind National Lampoon, appeared in Spinal Tap as their manager with the cricket bat, Ian Faith. He is also responsible for being the creative force behind the new National Lampoon original album, Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight? And we welcome Tony back to the show. Tony, welcome back.
Hey, yeah. How are you?
All right. Good. Let's start. Okay, what was it like at that time? You're working on Lampoon. You start Radio Dinner. Lemmings. You know, you cast these incredible talents, launching the careers of, as you mentioned, Chevy Chase and Christopher Guest and John Belushi and Harold Ramis and so on and so forth, people that would go on to be giants in the comedy world. What was it like at the beginning like that to be there?
Well, I mean, for me personally, you know, I'd been doing, as I said earlier, I've been doing this terrible American television, which restricted you, was completely sort of suppressed you. And I was suddenly amongst these people who had none of that censorship, or none of that self-censorship, or had any regard for any other kind of censorship. And it was literally like, I mean, I'd been operating on one cylinder for 4 or 5 years, and now I was operating on all six. And it was, it was like the Formula One of funny, you know, just going at max speed all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Kenny and Michael O'Donoghue and Henry Beard and Sean Kelly, Ann Beats. I mean, these people were just you couldn't drop your guard for a second with these people.
Yeah.
It was like swordplay all the time, you know. But it was huge fun.
Yeah,
huge fun.
Yeah. And when Lemmings took off, you know, that must have been was that surprising to you, how Lemmings became such a monster?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I loved Belushi, especially, who I of course found at Second City in your city.
Yep.
And he was just an amazing talent. This kind of hairy ball of comedic, you know, bomb material. Like he was sort of rock and roll and humor all wrapped up into one, as I say, a hairy ball.
Yeah.
And so there was him, and then there was Chevy, who was kind of the complete opposite, who subverted every kind of comedy that you'd ever heard of, but was incredibly funny, subverting comedy itself. And then there was Christopher, who was just the most brilliant parodist I've ever come across, and remains so to this day. So I was very lucky, but I didn't think it would. We did Lemmings as a limited run because we wanted to do a live music album after Radio Dinner, because all the best cuts in Radio Dinner were musical, and we expected it to run for 6 weeks, and we opened it, and within like 2 or 3 weeks, it was sold out for months.
Yeah, amazing. Tell us about the album and the structure of Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight?
Yeah, sure. The word triggers in this is kind of the trigger word, because it refers not just to actual triggers of actual guns, but it also refers to trigger warnings and all these new things on campus, like safe spaces and microaggressions and so forth. Our album is structured as a purported college concert that we're doing at a small fictitious college, obviously, in a place called Trickle Down, Ohio. And the student body is so sensitized to trigger warnings and safe spaces and so forth, that they are deeply offended by the title of our album, and immediately start accusing us of using the deadly weapon of sarcasm. And one heckler even claims to be a sarcasm survivor. So that's the kind of setting in which we are now going to do our contemporary satire, which we launch into. And it's, relatively sort of innocuous stuff. I mean, a PSA about the TSA, in which they explain why they have to irradiate our balls in order to save the balls and
right.
The balls of the two-headed children that we will have, who will all have four balls. There's also a piece about the Bernie Sanders sex tape, which has just emerged.
Mm-hmm.
Which he made 40 years ago, and it's called Vermount Me, You Vixen, in which Bernie plays a pizza delivery boy. But the important thing about it is not free healthcare.
Very funny stuff. Well, it's great. It's really, really great stuff. Now, tell me about the formation of the Final Edition.
Okay, sure. The Final Edition was actually began in 19. God, get my centuries mixed up. It actually began in 2011, it was at the time the New York Times was in really bad straits. Well, it probably still is, but at the time everyone thought that the New York Times was actually going to go under, because newspapers were being destroyed by the internet. So we, a group of us, thought it would be really amusing, because we have no particular reverence for the New York Times, to do the final edition of the New York Times, specifically of nytimes.com. So that's what we did, and it was great. I mean, you know, the New York Times building is on fire, all the editors are running for the hills, and so forth. So that was, we did it with Slate magazine, and it was a big hit and got, you know, millions of hits and so forth and so on. And that, so that got us off to a big start as a website. And gradually we transitioned out of that into actually just being a satirical hub, which in turn quickly transitioned into the final edition Radio Hour at the beginning of 2012. And the final edition Radio Hour is closely modeled, of course, because I have no other ideas except Lampoon ideas on the National Lampoon Radio Hour, which basically was highly produced, immersive sketches, which hopefully are taking on subjects that normally you don't laugh at. And that's what we've been doing, along with, you know, along with other stuff. But we've been doing a weekly radio show for 4 or 5 years now.
And how many people on staff?
Well, there's not on staff. I mean, this is all pro bono, luckily.
Mm. Okay, you gotcha.
But I've got two very brilliant casts. One in New York and one in L.A., which comprised altogether probably about a dozen people. And what's nice about that is you get two very different sort of perspectives on the news and things that are going on in the country from either coast. So you know, that's the sort of basis of the final edition Radio. And you know, when the time came to actually do our first album, as I said earlier, it seemed natural to hook up with the Lampoon, since it's modeled so closely on the Lampoon legacy, and that's how Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight came to be.
Okay, and the album is called Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight, and you can get it through the Final Edition website, which is thefinaledition.com. It's on CD Baby and iTunes as well, and we have a link on our Facebook page at facebook.com/NickDShow. So, Tony, how did you feel about Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead, the documentary?
I thought it was great, actually, and I must say, every other history, most of which have been in books, of the National Lampoon, never did what Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead did brilliantly, which is sort of recreate the magazine by using lots and lots and lots of material from Lemmings and from the magazine and from our albums, so that instead of it just being another boring old, you know, rise and fall media documentary, it was actually recreated, I thought, rather brilliantly, why the Lampoon was what it was, why it sold a million copies a month, you know, in the 70s, that's the only other movie other than Spinal Tap which people come up to and say, hey, I saw the documentary, you were great at it.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy with it.
I thought I ate it up. I thought it was one of the best films of last year, and I really thought it was amazing. Another fascinating guy who is not with us anymore. You mentioned him a little bit earlier. Is Michael O'Donohue.
Right.
What was it like working with that guy? That guy must have been a force of nature.
Well, yeah. I mean, he was. He and I actually were quite close for a while until we had a fight. Which Michael had a fight with everybody he ever worked with. Part of the bill he presented for the pleasure of his company, but he was just incredibly brilliant, incredibly funny, and incredibly unexpected. I mean, he was like Kenny in that way. He was, you know, he grew up in upstate New York. It's a very unlikely place where a comedy genius that brilliant would be nurtured. We used to have like extended sort of verbal, I don't know, boxing matches or something, but he was just enormous fun to be around because of that, and you couldn't take your eye off the ball for 1 second, or he'd have you in, you know, pieces on the floor. A brilliant, brilliant guy.
And, he for those people who might not know, he's the first person to speak ever on Saturday Night Live. I want to feed your fingers to the Wolverines bit was the first thing ever on Saturday Night Live. It's him and Belushi.
It was the first cold opening. Yeah, absolutely.
It was the first cold open, and that was him. And he, he went on to be, he would do the fantastic impressions of sticking needles in his eyes and
Sullivan. Yes, it's luckily Ed Sullivan. I very much like that piece. I must say.
It's very, very, very funny. So after. You left National Lampoon. You did end up at some point with Spy. What was your experience like working with Spy magazine, which, for me was the progression into National Lampoon?
Yeah, well, I mean, Spy was sort of did things that we didn't do at the National Lampoon. Like it did brilliantly took apart the sort of what we call the celebritocracy that had grown up in the 80s and 90s. I don't think the founders, Graydon Carter and Kurt Anderson, would be hugely happy about a connection with the Lampoon, but it was. I mean, it was certainly in the larger sense. It was it kept the Lampoon light alive when the Lampoon itself was crashing and burning. I wrote for them for quite early on, and eventually became the editor in chief. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Tony, could you hang on again?
Yep, absolutely. Okay,
absolutely. Great. Thank you. Tony Hendra is with us, one of my comedy heroes. Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight is the new album from National Lampoon, their first in 35 years. You can check it out at thefinaledition.com. We have more to talk about National Lampoon and more. And I got some Spinal Tap questions as well, and that's coming up right after we take a break here for weather and traffic. And I got the weather right here.
15 life-changing quotes.
5 amazing pictures artists painted using only a cat whisker and pond water.
How one man created dynamic, powerfully branded content while lying in a coma.
Apartment unlocked after 100 years reveals skeleton of tenant still whining about noise from skeleton upstairs.
Take our quiz. Can you identify Premier League footballers by their SAT scores?
Can you tell which Federal Reserve chairman came from these...
Surgeon General declares 60% of Americans overweight, with remaining 40% in constant fear of being eaten.
That's from the album Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight, which is the first National Lampoon record in 35 years. It's available at thefinaledition.com, CD Baby, iTunes, and we have a link on our Facebook page. One of the creative forces behind that and a comedy hero for me is on the show, Tony Hendra. We welcome Tony back. Tony, that's very funny stuff.
Great. I'm glad you like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I do have Spinal Tap questions for you.
I hope I can answer them.
I mean, obviously, as we mentioned before, the film has become iconic. I don't know. In the theater, I probably saw it 50 times in the theater, and I've watched it at home on DVD over and over and over and over again. And I had the big bootleg version with all the extra footage and all that stuff.
Right.
I've seen some footage of you talking about you were in a weird place when Spinal Tap hit you. When you were in a kind of a bad place when Christopher Guest and Rob Reiner came to you with this.
I wasn't doing badly exactly, but I mean it was the Lampoon. I had to leave the Lampoon because I was had a big sort of fight with P.J. O'Rourke and the management of the Lampoon over the Lampoon's direction, which was really a shame, because rather than growing up with its audience, which I thought the Lampoon should do, it decided to become basically a teen magazine, basically jerking off in cars and stuff like that. So that wasn't really my cup of tea. So I was kind of disappointed at that. But although, I had done some sort of interesting things on my own, like Not the New York Times and a few other things. Mm-hmm. But certainly, when Rob Reiner, that is, called me, he was an old friend of mine, and said, we're doing this we're doing this rock and roll parody movie. And we'd like you to be in it. We want you to play the manager, and he's like this really sleazy, untrustworthy guy, and we think you'd be just perfect for it. So certainly I jumped at that, and it was it was a great project because instead of writing a screenplay, which is any writer knows what a misery that is. You write the screenplay, you send it to Hollywood, and then, you know, 6 or 8 months later, they tell you they hate it.
Yeah.
We did a what would be described in television as a pilot. We shot or improvised about 20 minutes of what would be in the movie, and it included some of the scenes that did end up in the movie. And that was how we sold it, and it was a damn sight easier than writing a screenplay.
Yeah.
So that's how it came to be. And in fact, when we shot the movie itself in 1982. We did improvise everything. I mean, there was a scenario. All the scenes were laid out, you know, but you had to, in each scene, you had to get from A to B on your own steam. Yeah. And that's one of the things I think that makes it so fresh and convincing.
Yeah.
Because we're all feeling our way as we go, you know.
And the fact that, I mean, the people that are in the movie are such amazing improvisers. I can't imagine how much footage there was. I mean, that was cut out of the film. That was, I would imagine, as brilliant as the stuff that was in the movie.
Well, I don't know. I can't remember the exact footage, but I know that it was like something like four times what you would normally get from you know, the footage that you'd shoot in a 90-minute movie.
Yeah.
400,000 feet or something. I mean, you know, if laid end to end, it would I don't know.
Yeah.
Be bigger than Donald Trump's ego, I actually don't know where that footage is, and people have often said, is there another Spinal Tap in the offing? Is there a sequel? And there may be somewhere in that, you know, 300,000 feet that we didn't use, but I doubt it, because most of it was. We would do it in two or three takes. You know, the first take would be either great, and then you do one for safety, or it wouldn't be great, and you have to do a couple more until, you know, Rob liked it. And so that's where a lot of it came from. It was an expensive way, at least time-wise, it was an expensive way to do a movie, but it paid off.
It certainly did. I think there's a stroke of genius to within the film, you know, and it was improvised, but there's such a beautiful arc to the story that is really unexpected. And I think bringing in his girlfriend and to the point where your character quits, it was a stroke of genius to have that conflict in there. It really made, you know.
It was a mockumentary. I mean, it was a documentary in shape, and that would not happen in a documentary.
Yeah.
That's what's great about it. Yeah, really? June Chad, she was wonderful.
Classic stuff. And you smashing in TVs with a cricket bat is just genius. I want to mention...
Well, obviously, you know, the way I felt about television, even in the 70s, at the end of the 70s.
Yeah. Getting it out of your system. Before I let you go, and again, it's been an unbelievable pleasure to have you on, Tony.
Been a pleasure to be on.
I want to ask you about a futile and stupid gesture, the film that's being made about National Lampoon for Netflix. Are you consulting on it? Have you been involved at all?
Well, no, I haven't been involved. It's based on a book by Josh Karp, which is called A Stupid and Futile Gesture,
right,
which obviously is a line from Animal House.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way I was connected, really, is that for the first time in my life, somebody was actually cast to play me.
That's right, Matt Lucas.
Matt Lucas.
For people might remember him, he was Rebel Wilson's brother and roommate in Bridesmaids.
Yes, exactly. Two very, very large people, and very funny. And Rebel Wilson actually did a brilliant British accent. But the weird thing about Matt being cast as me is that when I appear in the movie, it's like the early 70s, at which point, you know, I weighed 160 pounds and had hair down to my butt crack. And Matt probably weighs 300 pounds and is completely, you know, shaven head.
Right.
So I don't know. I'm intrigued to see how it comes off, how I come off in this movie.
Yeah.
It's a very selfish point of view, but it sounds like it's great.
Will Forte is playing Doug Kenny. Seth Green is Christopher Guest. Joel McHale is Chevy Chase. Thomas Lennon, Michael O'Donoghue. I mean, they've loaded the cast with extraordinarily talented people. So I really hope it turns out good.
Yeah, I think it will.
Okay,
I think it will.
Great. Listen, Tony, again, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on the show. You're one of my heroes, seriously. And National Lampoon has released their first original album in 35 years. It's called Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight? You can check it out at thefinaledition.com, CD Baby, iTunes, and we have a link on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Pleasure. Thanks again.
Me too. Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care. There you go. Tony Hendra, everybody. Well, that was amazing. Okay. Going to take a break now. We're going to go to the news. It's Nick DiGilio.